This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A brutal heat wave across the south and west is causing dangerously high temperatures and killing crops. Some farmers in the Houston area also facing this dilemma.
Farmers plant crops that do everything from feed livestock herds to putting veggies on your plate. And with the extreme heat and drought, many of them are suffering reduced crops or a full crop loss as a result.
Extreme weather is destroying crops in Queensland's Salad Bowl region. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of fruit and vegetables have already been dumped as growers brace for the third heat wave in a month.
As heat waves and wildfires ravage across Europe, the United Kingdom has formally declared drought in parts of England. Amidst water shortage, a risk of power outages and also crop failures looming across the United Kingdom.
Dry rivers, cracked earth and wilted plants. This was the scene just last week in the rural farmlands of Chongqing. As a result, some local farmers say they are getting 80% less yield than usual.
Farmers are worried their crops and livelihoods are being destroyed.
Some hard news here. Scientists find global food production will drop around 25% in a heated world, despite adaptation by farmers and new technology. Two plant scientists now explain cutting-edge tools to prepare key crops for climate change. From the University of Illinois, Dr. Stephen Long reports on biotech breakthroughs to protect photosynthesis from climate change. Canadian evolutionary botanist Sam Yeaman asks, can wild plant adaptations help crops tolerate heat? Exploring the future of food in a damaged climate, this is Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On our current path, Southeast Asia will suffer through 300 days a year with a heat index exceeding 41 degrees C, 300 days above almost 106 Fahrenheit. People may survive, but crops feeding billions may not. Can we develop plants for a hotter world? Dr. Stephen P. Long is part of a group of scientists with the new paper, Safeguarding Crop Photosynthesis in a Rapidly Warming World. Born in the UK, Long is professor of plant biology and crop sciences at the University of Illinois. He is also visiting professor in plant sciences at Lancaster University and at Oxford in the UK. As Wiki says, his work published in Science proved that photosynthesis can be manipulated to increase plant productivity, an idea once considered the holy grail of plant biology. From Champaign, Illinois, Stephen Long, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Indeed, and thank you for your interest.
Let's break this down as you do in your paper. First, we assess the situation of agriculture and food. Then we can at least peek into the complex world of plant engineering. You've been engaged in this for years, and I don't think it's just for the intellectual challenge or some corporate profits. Is it fair to say your team, led in this case by Carl Bernacchi, see developing heat as a really serious threat to human food in the future?
Absolutely. The rising temperatures are a major threat, particularly the fact that it isn't just the average temperatures rising, but the frequency of extreme heat waves, which can be really damaging to crops, particularly in, obviously, the warmest parts of the globe, but even in temperate zones. We're seeing heat damage to crops.
Yes, in my garden, I can be having a good year, but if I get 4 days of extreme heat and the plants basically either stop growing or die off, then it doesn't recover even if the good climate comes back for the rest of the fall.
Yes, and of course that is what is happening for our crops and will be increasingly as we go forward.
Millions of farmers have already experienced this in places like Pakistan and India and parts of Africa. Well, look, in my greenhouse, Stephen, plants stop growing around 95 degrees Fahrenheit. That's what I've seen anyway, around 35 C. Are there different thresholds of temperatures, like an upper limit for plant growth, before actual damage from the heat?
If temperature exceeds 45 degrees Celsius, then there's usually irreversible damage. But depending on the crop, that can occur at considerably lower temperatures.
So the paper talks about a critical threshold of 40 degrees C, 104 Fahrenheit for some plants, or 45 for others, before what you call irreversible losses. Now, does that mean a loss of growth or a loss of plant cells or perhaps the death of the plant itself? What do you mean by irreversible losses?
Well, that is damage to the photosynthetic apparatus of the plant. So the way the plant gains its carbohydrates, everything that makes the plant up. And obviously, if that process is damaged irreversibly, then the plant can no longer grow and maintain itself.
How do high temperatures interfere with photosynthesis?
Two effects. One is that they damage critical enzymes, particularly an enzyme that activates and maintains the activity of an enzyme we call Rubisco. This is the enzyme which, in all plants, assimilates carbon dioxide into carbohydrates. So it's the most abundant protein on the planet, and it's sort of key to everything that drives the biosphere and provides our food. The second effect that we can see is that as temperature rises, the drying power of the atmosphere increases exponentially. So at these high temperatures, water is poured out of the plant at a very high rate. And so we're compounding the effects of temperature with also desiccation.
It's counterintuitive, but there can be too much solar energy for photovoltaic panels to produce properly. What do plants do when there is just too much light?
Yes, evolution has given plants a mechanism to defend itself against too much light. And without that mechanism, the chlorophyll in the leaf will absorb light energy, and the excess energy can actually start to damage the photosynthetic apparatus. So what has happened during evolution is plants have developed a method by which that excess light is then converted to heat and lost harmlessly from the leaf. And we call that sort of a photoprotective mechanism.
And human sweat to cool down our skin. I gather plant leaves use a similar process, but talk to us about the bottlenecks of interior water management in plants when a heat wave arrives.
Yes. If plants have sufficient water, what they can do is they have pores in the leaf which allow carbon dioxide to enter, and as it does, water escapes. Now, the leaf can cool itself by opening those pores wider so that more water is evaporating, and that cools the leaf surface. There are two factors here. One is that, if you like, the pipes which connect the stem to these pores in the leaf, do they have enough capacity? And the number of plants, they don't. So they reach a point where they simply can't supply the pores, the stoma in the leaf, with enough water. The other factor, of course, is that in many situations, there just isn't enough water in the soil. So a plant will normally respond to drought by actually closing its stomata to maintain what water is left, or making sure its tissue is not killed by desiccation. And of course, if there's drought, then the leaf cannot cool itself.
We've already smashed long-standing heat records around the world, and scientists predict more and more extreme heat waves. Now, one abstract for your new paper says, quote, protective measures within plants can be induced by growth at elevated temperatures, but not from the sudden temperature elevation of heat waves. Well, that sounds like science and biotech may not be able to save crops from big heat waves. What do you think?
There are protective measures which will typically give a plant maybe 3 or 4 degrees Celsius more tolerance. And if temperatures rise gradually, these processes are induced. If it's sudden, as you say, the damage can occur before this protection even arises. And one thing that biotech can do is to add means to stimulate that production more rapidly, or essentially have that protection expressed all of the time.
Well, getting to the solutions, let's go back to a 2016 breakthrough paper in Science you worked on. The title is Improving Photosynthesis and Crop Productivity by Accelerating Recovery from Photoprotection. How were you able to, quote, improve photosynthesis?
Yes, as we were discussing earlier, when a leaf receives more light energy than it can use in photosynthesis, it induces this photoprotective process, which converts the excess absorbed energy into heat. Now, when a leaf goes into the shade, for example, as a cloud crosses the sun, or as it becomes shaded by other leaves above, and in a dense crop canopy, this is occurring all of the time. When it goes into the shade, this photoprotective process continues for many minutes, and now the leaf could use all of the light it's receiving in photosynthesis, but it is dissipating quite a lot of that energy in this photoprotective process unnecessarily. So together with colleagues at University of California, Berkeley, we identified three genes which were coding for proteins which, if we upregulated them, we believe would speed up this process. And so that's what we did. And indeed, it did speed the process up. It meant that the crop photosynthesis was more efficient, and we saw more productivity.
Well, the crop in question was tobacco, and I have to ask, why would a team choose to boost productivity of tobacco? Is it a handy test plant?
Yeah. The only reason for using tobacco is that it's very quick to genetically modify. It's very easy to genetically modify tobacco. Then because it produces a large amount of seed, you can quickly move to a trial in the field. And you can do that within a year. For crops which we care about, like soybean, cowpea, wheat, etc., that is a 3 or 4 year process and considerably more expensive. So we use tobacco as our guinea pig. You know, does this really work in the field situation with a real crop, but obviously not one that we care about for food production?
In the new paper in Science, published June 12th, your group evaluates four possible doorways into changing plant capabilities. And the first is modifying surface energy balance. That sounds pretty technical. Could you give us an example?
Yes, for example, you know, if you look at different plants, maybe in your garden, you see some of them have leaves which look a bit white. You know, that's because they've got the surface of the leaf has hairs or waxes which refract the light and cause it to reflect. So those leaves will be cooler than the dark green leaves, for example. And we know in a number of our major crops there is variation in this reflectivity. You know, we've been modeling this and realized that, you know, if you're considering the hotter world, though although you're reflecting some of the light away, which you might want to use in photosynthesis, you're cooling the leaf. And so the net benefit is greater by making it more reflective. Another change you can make is to make the leaves more vertical. You know, if you look at, say, a modern wheat field, you might see six layers of leaves. Now, the upper layer of the leaf is absorbing most of that light, and you know, much that it can't actually use in full sunlight. If you make the leaves more vertical at the top, then more of the light can penetrate down to those shaded leaves, and the heat load on those upper leaves is less. So you're spreading out the heat load, and the average temperature is therefore lower, and those upper leaves are less likely to be damaged by heat. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I quite understand it. I have seen this in some of my garden plants, that I'll have two varieties, and one, the structure is sort of wide open to grab all the sunlight directly overhead, and others are a little more protective and suspicious. So I have seen this. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Stephen Long from the University of Illinois. Dr. Long is an acknowledged expert in plant physiology and photosynthesis. So you also looked into improving the heat tolerance of enzymes within the plant, and frankly, without a degree in botany, it's hard to follow that discussion. Can this avenue to help plants survive heat be explained in common language?
Yes. One of the key enzymes is the one which actually maintains the activity of the carboxylase Rubisco. That is the enzyme which captures carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Now, the enzyme which activates Rubisco, we call it Rubisco activase, is very temperature labile in most crops. Yet we know, for example, cacti can function at a much higher temperature. So what scientists are trying to understand is, well, what is different about their activase that allows that to function at a higher temperature? And what we're starting to see is there may be specific components of that protein which we could then alter in the crop protein. So that would be the one way to address this important vulnerability of photosynthesis.
Of course, the time-tested solution to find better plant varieties is crossbreeding, observation, and selection. Is that going to be enough, and is it going to be fast enough to solve what might be a disastrous food crisis when temperatures go beyond crop tolerances?
One of the areas that we've got limited information about is, what is the variation within, you know, all of the varieties of a crop and its relatives, the relatives that have been crossed with it? Where we have got information suggests there could be quite a lot of variation there that could be exploited in conventional breeding. It still takes maybe 10 to 15 breeding cycles to really have something that can get into a farmer's field. So time is short. And the major problem there is that generally there's been a rundown in the number of plant breeders in the world. Plant breeding capacity has diminished for our crop plants, except, of course, in the multinational companies. But they're, of course, focused on the crops which deliver a large profit, which is primarily North American corn, to a lesser extent soybean, whereas we really need to see progress in wheat and rice and the crops that are very important in tropical areas such as cowpea, which is a major protein source in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So there is certainly an opportunity there which needs to be exploited, but it does need far more capacity to be built in. Essentially, it needs more investment in plant breeding, more investment in the training of plant breeders, and giving them the modern facilities which can really speed up the whole process. Now, when it comes to genetic modification, if a crop is transgenic, i.e. you've introduced foreign DNA to make that crop more temperature resistant, then even in countries which accept transgenic crops, such as the United States, Canada, now Nigeria in Africa, for example, Australia, Argentina and Brazil, even in those countries, there's a very challenging regulatory network that you have to work through. I mean, it costs billions to work through that for just one change. And again, it would probably be 15 years, if successful, before anything is in a farmer's field. Now, there is another factor, and that is now gene editing, where, obviously, in evolution, you're getting mutations occurring all the time, where one amino acid and protein has been changed. And what we can now do is, with what is called gene editing, precisely make those modifications. So you're not bringing in any foreign DNA after you've made that modification. And a number of countries are now accepting that as being non-transgenic. That is a faster process, and you might expect to deliver something on about the same time frame as conventional plant breeding. But none of this is going to be fast. And although the opportunity is there, it isn't going to happen at the scale we need it without far more attention being given to the great concerns we have ahead.
As you know, Stephen, many people distrust or fear biotechnology. How do you, as experts in the field, assess risk and protect against misadventure or unintended consequences?
Yeah, governments, together with the NGOs, which have been against biotechnology, have developed these very rigorous frameworks where you have to prove that this biotechnology won't spread where it's not wanted, that the proteins you're now producing are safe, they don't have any toxicity. So it's really far more rigorous control than we have on conventional breeding, where you could take a gene from a crop ancestor, that may be an allergen, could be slightly toxic, put it into a crop, and that doesn't need to be tested necessarily. So the controls around biotechnology are way tougher than they are around anything we're doing conventionally. And of course, if we look at everyday life, for example, billions of people around the world are on insulin. That is a biotech product entirely. The human gene has been put into a bacterium, which makes the protein, and that is what goes into your insulin. So it's actually far safer than what was being done before, where we were using, for example, insulin from pigs rather than the exact human form.
Yes, I particularly worry about little plastic bits getting into my brain and all of that. None of that is regulated either. Now, suppose a lab creates a new variety of rice that can withstand extreme heat waves and still yield a good harvest. How would that be distributed, and can it reach even poor farmers?
Yes, we have a very good example of that. What was happening with climate change is that rice, of course, is an aquatic plant. Its roots are in, the base of the plant is in water, the top is in the air. But with climate change, what was happening is we're getting more and more severe floods, which essentially drowned rice fields. So the whole crop was submerged. And rice cultivars cannot or could not survive submergence for more than a couple of weeks. So farmers' crops were killed, and this was many of the poorest farmers had the fields which were most likely to get flooded. Now, looking at a series of rice cultivars, scientists discovered a gene which actually protected the crop against this. And they tested this by transgenically taking that gene and putting it into a flood-intolerant cultivar and showing they could make it resistant to this flooding. So what they then did was, take the line which had the gene, which made the crop flood intolerant, and then cross that with many of the cultivars which were being used across Southeast Asia, particularly by poor farmers. And this got into seed systems. It was available to farmers without any cost to them for the technology. And it was adopted very quickly. And today, most of those crops are protected against this flooding event. So we do have an example where once you've got something that is really good, you can then get it into the seed systems, where the farmers buy their seed, and that becomes available. There's a very good example in Nigeria as well, where scientists from Australia and Nigeria were working together to put a gene into cowpea that would make it resistant against an insect which would bore into the pod and basically destroy a farmer's crop. And again, that became a vet and is now in the seed systems in the country, and farmers are taking that on and buying that rapidly. And again, this is one where there is no charge for the technology to the farmer. So we do have some good examples, but we need many, many more of those. We won't really get them without having more plant breeders to work with the biotechnologists and more resources put into this, particularly where it's most needed.
Well, I think part of that is not to abandon the field to corporations who are looking for quarterly profits and keeping up public funding, which is in danger in some countries.
Yes, I mean, one of the things we've learned from really corporate activities, if we look at North American corn, it, in the past 50 years, its yields have more than doubled. A lot of that, of course, are technologies which did come from the public domain, but have been used and developed by these corporations to get more productive maize. So, it does give us an example. When enough effort is put into it, you could improve the other crops that we really need to be improved. So it is really just a question of, investments and effort.
Everyone knows the real solution is to stop burning fossil fuels on a super emergency basis, but there is no sign of that happening. I sense you want to help in the world as it is with your work. Stephen Long, what keeps you going?
What keeps me going is the fact that we can see that there are opportunities to future-proof our crops. And discovering those opportunities, trying to help get them to where they're really needed, is really what keeps me going. I mean, I'm fascinated by the mechanism underlying all of this, of course. But, that's been my career for 50 years. But using the discovery we've made around all of these mechanisms, and of course with the other scientists working on this issue over the world, and then using that for the good is what keeps me going. It's ironic, really, the United States has withdrawn a huge amount of its USAID funding, which was particularly supporting this in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think the UK has also withdrawn quite a bit of its funding because it needs to shore up its defences. And I think the world is just not aware of the impending food crisis. Well, I say impending, 10% of the world is starving at the present time. And that isn't just because of conflicts. That is simply that in many parts of the world, people just cannot produce enough food. And they can't afford to buy it from elsewhere.
From the University of Illinois, we've been speaking with Dr. Stephen P. Long. Among his many positions, Stephen is director of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation project called Realizing Increased Photosynthetic Efficiency Project, or RIPE. Steve, we appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, and thank you for your interest and for getting the word out about this very important problem facing the world at a time when I is really focused on many other issues.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Scientists warn the crops that feed billions of us may not survive climate change. A new article in the journal Science asks, can wild plant adaptations help crops tolerate heat? The author is Dr. Sam Yeaman from the University of Calgary Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. From Calgary, Canada, Sam Yeaman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
So what is the problem you and other authors in this special edition of Science are trying to solve?
Well, broadly, people are just very interested in understanding how plants will deal with stress and deal with climate stress associated with changing climate in the world right now. and really just understanding the myriad ways that that climate stress will impact plants, crop plants as well as other plants in general, to try to predict how they'll respond to changes over time. And really there's a complex suite of traits that plants use to deal with various kinds of stresses that are associated with climate, so high temperature, low temperature, drought. All these kinds of things affect different species in different ways, and different species use a wide range of strategies to try to tolerate these problems. And so people, in this particular issue, people have been focused on heat tolerance especially and heat stress, and as one of the main components of the kind of stresses we expect with climate change, and really just trying to learn about how different species will contend with that stress.
Yes, we talked with Dr. Stephen Long in Illinois about tactics scientists can try to develop extra heat tolerance in commercial crops. Why do you suggest looking into wild plants?
Well, I think we're interested in wild plants particularly because we just it's such a black box. We don't know how variable these stress response solutions are from one species to another. A lot of the main work on plant physiology and plant genetics is done on either Arabidopsis thaliana, thalecress, which is the model species in plants, or on some crop species, you know, a few select crops that are very, very heavily studied. And we actually don't know how typical what we see in these species is of other, say, less studied crops or of plants in general. And so really, because the species that we're studying deeply represent only a small portion of the diversity on Earth, it's really amazing and fascinating to just look at how different populations and different species do adaptation and how they contend with these stresses. And we really, as I said, it's a bit of a black box. We're only just beginning to crack open what that diversity is. And, you know, is it the case that if you look at something like a sunflower and a pine tree, are they going to be adapting to stress, heat stress differently or in some ways the same? And those are questions we're really just starting to probe and get some answers on.
Well, yes, there's hundreds of thousands of plant species at least in this world, and that's a big haystack if you're looking for climate adaptation clues. How could we approach it?
Well, what we've been doing, what a lot of scientists have been trying to get at is taking many different wild species that have ranges, natural ranges of their distribution that span a lot of variation in environments. So lodgepole pine is one example species I've worked on quite a bit, that it grows from way up in northern Canada and the Yukon all the way down into California. And as you can imagine, that spans a very wide range of climates. And we can see that there's actually different mutations that are present at high versus low frequency, so they're common or rare, depending on which kind of environments they're found in. And so we do a lot of genome sequencing to identify these mutations, and then statistical analysis to search for these kinds of associations that would suggest that a particular gene is really important in adapting to a given stress. And when we do that in one species, we get a bit of a hint, and there's a lot of statistical noise and difficulties in studying it. But what really is quite amazing is when we start looking at many species, we can say, well, is this particular gene strongly associated with heat stress in 10 different species? And so now that we're starting to assemble genome data on many different species, it actually becomes possible to do that kind of comparative work and say, oh, look, there's adaptation to heat stress signal at this one gene in 7 out of 10 of the different species we look at, and casting the net increasingly broadly across more and more species, trying to find what we call these signatures of natural selection. So they're kind of patterns in the genome that we see through sequencing many hundreds of individuals within a single species to try to find these associations. And then we look for repeated patterns of association across lots of species.
Given the dire predictions, like maybe 2.7 degrees C of warming as early as 2080 in one study I've just covered, do you think there isn't enough time for old-school breeding of crops to handle the coming challenges? Do we need bioengineering now?
That's a very, very good question, and one I don't know the answer to that. And I think One thing that I think is really interesting about doing these wild species studies is they give us a bit of insight into how well conventional breeding might be able to work. So if it's the case that we find very little repeated adaptation, so if we find that there's actually every single crop is doing it a different way, or every single wild species is doing it a different way, and we don't see the same gene involved in heat tolerance over and over again, that actually suggests that there's lots and lots of different ways that nature is able to adapt to a given stress. And that flexibility would suggest that there's actually a lot of potential to do conventional breeding. Because if nature has been able to adapt to the same stress very large number of different ways, then it will be easier for conventional breeding to actually also pursue gradual increases in heat tolerance. And this has certainly been done with great effect already in a lot of species, so we do know a lot about the genetics of some stress tolerance traits. But really learning how wild species do it will help us understand how likely that it is to work. On the other hand, if we can see that, you know, every time a species adapts to an extreme heat in nature, they're using gene X, that would suggest that there's actually not very many ways for nature to solve this problem. You know, over and over again, different species are using that same gene to adapt to that same stress. That would suggest that it might be a little harder to get results with conventional breeding. And this is, of course, a bit of a caricature of the true problem. What we'll probably see is that there's a bit of a mixture where there's some repeated evolution. We see that some of the same genes being involved over and over again, and some kind of non-repeated stuff. And so I think we're just on the verge of learning about that side of things right now. I think that regardless of whether conventional breeding is enough, there's certainly a good case to be made for the value in particularly gene editing and these kind of newer ways of modifying our crops to contend with these things. I think there's a good case for that to be something we should be looking hard at.
Many of us, I think, in the public think, well, we'll just find this magic gene that we can take from one plant and toss it into another, and there you go. And I know it's not that simple. There's all sorts of things that those genes need to function. There's enzymes, there's proteins they expect, there's chains of things that go with them. But is it possible to take something from one type of plant, put it in another, and have the crop handle heat better?
It's possible, but as you say, it's probably not that simple, and that's particularly for the case of complex traits like stress adaptation. We know generally these kinds of traits tend to be what we call highly polygenic, so polygenic meaning many genes, and they tend to involve mutations and variation present at many different genes in the genome. And so it's kind of like saying, you know, you need to involve many different enzymes, many different proteins, and changes in many of these to actually get a really good solution. And so it probably won't be the case where there's a single magic bullet that does it, but it may be the case that by doing lots of small changes, we're able to gradually improve these. And I think we're at a real turning point in terms of both how the gene editing biotechnology advances are being made and also in our understanding of these complex polygenic traits. And a really difficult problem is that the more polygenic something is, the more it includes a large number of genes, the smaller the effects of those individual mutations tend to be, and the tougher a problem it is to figure out which ones are actually important. I think we're really at a point where there's a lot of excitement and a lot of research in this, but it's early days to know how effective these kinds of solutions will be.
Many key agricultural regions face not just the single stress of heat waves, but also drought, perhaps followed by extreme rainfall and flooding. In the paper, you do talk about, quote, alleles associated with temperature or amount of precipitation, so far breeding looks at one or another, end quote. Is it possible to develop food crops to survive different kinds of extreme events? It sounds like we're sort of needing superhero wheat or superhero rice, because they're going to have to face so many different threats.
Yeah, well, I should preface this with saying I'm really an evolutionary biologist and not an expert on any particular crop. And so my knowledge is limited sometimes with those specific, a specific crop example. But it certainly is possible to do conventional breeding for multiple different traits and to do these modern biotechnology approaches for multiple different traits simultaneously. Now, there's some interesting crossovers a lot of plants do, if you have a plant that tends to be highly drought tolerant, it often will tend to be highly cold tolerant. And so there's, you get interesting similarities in the physiology of how plants deal with certain kinds of stress. And so to some extent, stress tolerance can be a bit of a broad trait, but then for other kinds of stresses and for other particular changes, they can be much more specific and not general to other stresses. So sometimes a particular mutation that might increase your heat tolerance won't have any effect on, say, your drought tolerance or your cold tolerance. And so that's certainly an area of very active research, is trying to understand the generality with which, you know, does a stress tolerance mutation help you broadly with many different stresses or specifically with a particular kind of stress? The other big question, of course, is whether there's trade-offs and if a stress tolerance mutation comes at the cost of reduced yield, which, of course, is very important for crops.
Well, so much data out there about plants. Humans have been fascinated by them for millennia, really. Do you think artificial intelligence is going to help with this search for heat clues?
That's also a great question. It's certainly, there's a lot of work being done right now applying large language models and various uses of artificial intelligence to try to understand patterns in the genome. These models usually work by training the artificial intelligence model on existing data and then being able to detect those patterns in new data, similar kinds of patterns. And so a real problem here is that there's so much we don't know about what adaptation and what stress tolerance looks like in the genome that training these models is still quite challenging and even understanding what it is that they're learning. So I mean, I think we're certainly in an era where we're going to see a lot of progress using these kinds of models, and people have looked at genomic data, say, representing when you have lots and lots of individuals that have been sequenced, you can kind of stack all of their sequence reads up together and it looks like an image. And so you can use image analysis tools from artificial intelligence to try to look for patterns in that. And certainly there's a lot of areas of promise. I think we're still early days in how much and what kinds of results we'll see from that.
Gardeners talk about companion plants, plants that work well together, and some plants are dependent on each other. So I wonder if analyzing each plant's genetics separately may miss that cooperation and interaction in the ecosystem. If that is important, is coexistence of plants beyond the reach of genetic analysis approach?
Well, I wouldn't say it's beyond the reach. It's certainly a more complicated problem. If you have a real dependence between two or more species, then you have to start studying two or more species simultaneously, and that's, you know, just, it's a bit tougher. Certainly, those kinds of synergies have been known for a really long time. Indigenous peoples of North America used the squash, bean, maize, the three sisters that complement each other in agriculture, and there's a lot of different kind of innovative practices in agriculture that have been used with complementation. Those tend to not be applied in kind of industrial scale agriculture. But again, that's pretty beyond my expertise, but I know there's a lot of interesting ground for work there. And certainly it's not beyond the realm of genetics. It's just, it's already pretty tough to study a single species at a time. So adding in multiple species just makes the problem all the more complicated.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with Dr. Sam Yeaman from the University of Calgary. We are talking about how wild plants may have answers for our crops in the coming extreme heat. According to a University of Oxford study, the unprecedented heat wave in Russia in 2010 slashed wheat production by 25%. This hurts exports and increased food costs in many other countries. Now, the heat is worse now. If there was a globally significant crop loss in key grain like a rice or a corn, I'm sure governments and people would demand some sort of action. But from what I'm hearing, talking to scientists like you, it takes a long time to develop and distribute a better variety equipped for heat waves. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. This is not something you can do overnight. Even with traditional crop breeding, you're stuck with the fact that you need to grow the crop up, then you need to assess its performance, and you need to pick the best performing individuals for crossing and rearing the next generation. And that all takes time, even with conventional breeding. Editing, of course, and gene modification techniques are also time and labor intensive. And so these are many year solutions. It's not something that we'll just be able to say, okay, we had a bad year, next year we'll plant this better crop. This is going to be a multi-year or even decadal problem that requires investment now.
Well, speaking of investments, in America, one government-funded study was cut apparently because the grant contained the word transgenic. I guess that was mistaken for transsexuality by some AI. When governments are slashing research funding, are you optimistic your field can continue, perhaps funded by private companies or foundations?
I think that's a really bad model for science in general. Trusting private companies to be able to have the distance of vision and the breadth of vision beyond their bottom line is just, it's very unlikely that they're going to make risky investments that are necessary for this kind of big vision science to happen. So I'm a really strong believer in strengthening government funding of research. And I think that we've seen so many success stories over the past century through government-funded success, government-funded research. If we give up on that and assume that private companies are going to take up the slack, I think we will see an incredible loss in both talent and in new developments.
What about the wide world of plants outside human cultivation? I mean, must we abandon them to a game of survive who can as we overheat the planet? What do you see happening for land-based green life in coming centuries?
That's a really critical problem. And not just plants, but all of life on Earth is facing incredible stress with climate change. Plants are particularly affected because they can't move, so they don't have behavioral things that allow them to, you know, hide under a rock when it gets hot. So we're going to see big impacts on plants in general, and wild plants, we are already losing many species, and we're likely going to see those losses increase. Whether we can do targeted things to help particular species or not is a big question. And I think that, you know, there are certainly targeted conservation strategies for species of particular importance. But I think that that case-by-case, species-by-species approach isn't going to be practical for a lot of, if we really want to save a lot of diversity and maintain a lot of this biodiversity we have in the world, we're going to have to work more on, I think, conserving process and really trying to maintain wide areas of natural environment where species can actually have the space to persist and not be impacted by human activities as they are and the expansion of human activity. I think that conserving that process is going to be incredibly important, but that might not be enough. I just read some articles recently about insects where insect diversity was found to be decreasing dramatically, even in areas of rainforest that were far away from human activity. And this is just thought to be due to climate change because the insects were experiencing problems due to drought. And so even if we're able to maintain good habitat for species, climate change may cause really severe problems, particularly with more rare species, with species that don't live as broadly across wide ranges of environment. So I have hope that we'll be able to mitigate some of the impacts of climate change, but we're certainly at a period where we're expecting to see a lot of shifts over the coming century.
And apparently part of the population in many countries is suspicious of both science and medicine. Are you concerned that public pressure or misinformation could derail sincere efforts to feed the world, even as we keep on with greenhouse gas emissions?
I sure am, deeply. And I don't know what to say about that, but it's just it's a huge problem in society right now. Is general mistrust of science seems higher than I can remember in my lifetime, and perplexing to someone that has spent their life really learning about the world through the lens of science. It's only one tool of many, and it has its limits, but it also has incredible strengths, and it's given us a lot of truly revolutionary changes. It seems amazing to me that we're seeing some people turn their backs on this so much.
Me too. What are you working on these days, Sam?
Well, the main thing in my lab is working on studying repeated adaptation. So I'm heading up a working group called the REPADAPT Working Group, where there's I think now over 70 people worldwide from different research labs at different universities and different countries collaborating to look at repeated adaptation. So we've got I think over 250 species now that people are contributing data from, where there's hundreds of individuals sequenced within each of those species. And we're just trying to cast this net even more broadly to try to understand how repeated adaptation to climate stress works across many, many different species. And we're now moving beyond plants. I'm very fascinated in, you know, will we see similar kinds of patterns in how evolution works when we look at insects or at fish or mammals? And really just seeing, you know, how repeated is adaptation when we look broadly across many different species. So that's a really fun project that we've been really pursuing deeply. And then we've got a local project here. I live near the Banff Rocky Mountains, where we look at white spruce and Engelmann spruce and how they hybridize together in the Rockies and adapt to the very complicated and extreme environments they find there. So we've got those are the two main studies we're working on right now.
I have to admit, I don't really understand the importance of the repeated part. Could you kind of explain that a bit?
The importance of repeated adaptation is that imagine, you know, there's a gene, say, flowering time, is a gene that was found in Arabidopsis thaliana, this model plant species, that was of known importance to changing when the plant decides to flower based on photoperiod. And we think that's a gene that's really important. We wonder, oh, if other species are also evolving and changing their flowering time, perhaps to avoid drought. Sometimes we know that plants try to flower earlier in the year. If they're adapting to drought stress, they may they may evolve to avoid that drought stress and flower early, so that they maybe don't make as many seeds, but they can still do their whole life cycle before things get dry. The question then is, you know, well, are other species also using that one flowering time gene to do that that same change in their habit? So if we can see that same gene being involved in many, many, many different species, then we can kind of say, well, that's a really highly repeated stereotyped response. But if every single species is changing their photoperiod response, changing their flowering time using a different gene, then that suggests there's a lot of flexibility in evolution. So it's really getting at this question of constraint. And if there's a lot of constraint, if there's this one key gene that really matters, then that's a gene that we could target for genetic engineering, for gene editing. Whereas if every single crop or every single plant and wild plant is doing it differently, is using a different gene to adapt to that drought stress, then that suggests there's a lot of flexibility in evolution. And so even within Arabidopsis, we can see evidence of other populations not using flowering time gene, using either, there's a recent study that was done on some islands off the coast of Africa where they found that different populations had mutations in the FLC, the flowering locust C gene, or in Frigida, another gene, and these were all involved in how they were changing their flowering time response. And so even within this one species, we could see that there were three different genes, depending on which population was evolving, that had been associated with changes in flowering time. And we can see that's a very stereotyped, simple response. Often traits like flowering time involve many, many, many mutations at many different genes. And so studying repeatability just helps us figure out, is adaptation something that's really flexible, where every species can do it differently, or is it highly constrained, where they're stuck? If they want to adapt to this given pressure, they need to use gene X, Y, and Z to do it.
Well, I'm hooked. I hope you'll get back when we get the answer. It sounds like a really interesting journey. From the University of Calgary, we've been speaking with researcher and associate professor Sam Yeaman. His article in the special June 12th issue of Science is titled, Can Wild Plant Adaptations Help Crops Tolerate Heat? It is free to read. Find a link in my blog at ecoshock.org. Sam, thank you for spending time with us.
Thanks very much, Alex. Really nice to chat.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
The new study in Nature on the loss of food production as the world warms is titled Impacts of Climate Change on Global Agriculture, Accounting for Adaptation. It was published June 18, 2025. It's free, open access. Find links in my blog at ecoshock.org. The CNN headline covering this paper is, "Children born now may live in a world where the U.S. can only produce half as much of its key food crops." Laura Patterson in The Guardian writes, "Maize, soy, rice, wheat, cassava, and sorghum yields are projected to fall by as much as 120 calories per person per day for every 1 degree C the planet heats up." That's according to new research in Nature, with average daily losses that could lead up to the equivalent of not having breakfast. The study found rising incomes and changes in farming practices could stem the losses by about a quarter by 2050 and by one-third by 2100, though they would not stop them entirely. That's an end quote from The Guardian, June 18th. These food losses come as the United Nations projects global population to go from around 8 billion today to almost 10 billion by 2050 and still climbing after that. We don't know how many more people will die simply because of climate-induced extremes like heat, floods, and wildfires, but we do know there will be less food to go around. As our guests tell us, just one or two new varieties of heat-resistant crops can take about 15 years to reach world farmers. The small group of bioplant experts is growing in some places like China, but shrinking in the West, and we may need a crash investment and research program to avoid repeated famines and a billion hungry people every day. Sadly, recently governments in some Western countries are going the other way. They are slashing funding for agricultural research and all science. At the same time, the United States and even Canada and Australia are cutting regulations about all this, too. Any artificial changes to plant life meant for release into the environment must have real regulation, safety testing, and risk assessment. That may not happen either. The problem comes if one bad actor or a simple well-meaning mistake cripples a main crop like wheat or rice for a year. Then society overreacts against all work of this type, perhaps banning future plant research, or at least things like gene editing or trans-species implants. There goes another hope to stabilize food, which helps stabilize civilization. Without enough food, revolutions, chaos, and corruption can flourish. Has climate change once again forced humans into a Faustian bargain? We make a deal with dangerous manipulation of basic processes, like photosynthesis, to overcome the damage of other dangerous things, like manipulation of the atmosphere. Future food is a wicked problem, my friends. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.
Like this, heat in winter, flood all of a sudden, winds are wilder, here we go. Ooh, they told us it would be all okay. They told us back to normal days. They never told us this, we were all until the power dropped. We were alright until the music stopped. Living life.
This